I'm Millie.
I'm Chris.
And this is Beggar's Belief, home of hoaxes, pranks, scams, shams, and charlatans. The story where you shouldn't believe what you're hear because not everyone's telling the truth.
Pretty close, pretty good.
Pretty close, I'll get it.
Pretty close, pretty close.
Give me like another 50 episodes, it's great. Every time it'll be different.
Different every time.
Okay.
That's how we know what episode we're on.
It's not the one where you started scatting.
I could do it again.
You could. You could. So for today's story, I need a preface.
Oh, I thought you were going to ask for a volunteer and I'm like, no.
You are my volunteer. You have no choice. You are my compatriot in this. I took French in college. My pronunciations were so bad, I was asked to leave the French class and I made my TA cry. So today's story takes place in France. So obviously a lot of French names, French place names. So I wanted to do my due diligence on looking up pronunciations for things. So I did the very logical thing and called up a Vampire the Masquerade streamer I know in France and asked him to help me out by writing these all down phonetically.
All right, good. I'm excited to hear
this is how goes. Everyone pronounces things in French, by the way, is you just have to have at least one Vampire the Masquerade player on your docket.
All right. Everybody listening at home, please remember that.
Yes. Yes. And shout out to Batsy. He makes me call him Batsy because I don't pronounce his actual name correctly. Yeah. So that gives you an idea of how bad my French is when my French friends will not let me say his name. So today's little mental image, again, going to drop you down into this and you need to picture yourself in the situation. So today I would like you to pretend you are a French peasant.
Je suis Christophe. Je m'appelle Christophe. Actually, my French is also very bad. Je ne parle pas français.
Okay, it just makes me feel less bad, actually.
Yeah, see? Mm-hmm. I took 4 years of that in high school, and that's what I came out with.
Oh, good, yeah. Good. The mid-1500s, you live in the parish of Languedoc.
All right, Languedoc?
Languedoc, according to the phonetic write-out I have.
All right.
Yes. In the town of Artigas. There's a lot of social structure in play, medieval times and all that. The influence of the Catholic Church in all of this. So there's going to be a lot of sociological discussion today. Just has to happen. In Artigas, you are in a somewhat unique area for the time. In this area, properties were handed down a little bit more diplomatically than okay. In some other parts of Europe. And inheritance were split between children instead of just given to the eldest and could be sold or rented off. Additionally, none of the peasants there pay a manorial due. So they own their own labor, basically. There's a slightly weird family in town.
Only slightly weird?
Yeah. I think, like, at the time, this would have been the family gossip or the local gossip.
So did they, not divide up the property, like, evenly?
We will get to that. There's going to be a lot with this family.
Okay.
This is the sort of family that you wouldn't be surprised it would be on, like, Jerry Springer if it was these.
Even better.
Yeah. Most of the residents in your town locally descended. But this family, the Gares, moved there. When they arrived, they spoke Basque, and probably still had an accent. Their son, Martin, was athletic, but slightly odd. As we'll discuss later, he was probably picked on a lot.
It sounds like me in high school.
Yeah, and the name Martin, in fact, was a Basque name that was very common, but locally happened to be the nickname that people gave to wild donkeys.
Not a great start. Not a great start.
No. So one day, Martin steals some grain from his father. There's a huge fight, and Martin storms off. He leaves behind his wife, Bertrand, and their newborn son, and he just doesn't come back.
Okay. That talk about going against the grain, that's how you do it.
So there's more gossip in town. Makes a really weird situation with his wife because there's no real social standing for an abandoned wife society. It doesn't exist.
Yeah, how do you divide things up evenly when one of the parties not there?
Well, not only that, but women couldn't own property.
Yeah, fair enough.
Okay. She can't remarry. She isn't allowed any claim to family money. And after the death of Martine's father, that money and the care of the two households they owned and the family businesses is in the care of Martin's uncle, Pierre. So there's a lot of gossip around the small town. 12 years later, Martin returns somewhat hat in hand. He's seen the world, was in the army, and is begging the forgiveness of his family. They take him back in. You see him around, chat with him, reminisce about your childhood, friends who have since passed, that sort of thing. Very normal. This being the time and place it is, you go to church together. It seems that Martin has taken to far more interested in the family business and is expanding his family's holdings and taking care of finance. He and Bertrand seem really happy to be reunited, raising their son, and they end up having another baby who survives.
Is it? Okay. Did the same Martine come back? Like, this is my question.
Here's the question Martine had. What did his Uncle Pierre do during the time that he had control of the family money? He's asking a lot of questions, and there's local rumors that wouldn't exactly like spots. Pierre might not have been as responsible with the money as he'd like. Plus, Pierre doesn't really seem pleased that he went from having sole control of two households with two farms and two businesses to being more of an advisory role. Mm. So Pierre starts rallying support for a scheme. He points out that Martine was gone for 12 years, and as you said, maybe it was a different who came back. Rumor mill, totally in our overdrive. Eventually, this goes to court. Now, you're just a local, but everyone is called to testify because the local priest says if you know anything, even suspicions, and you do not testify, you will be excommunicated from the church.
That's a pretty big deal at the time. Mm-hmm. That's okay.
So, how would you testify?
Oh, oui, of course, that is a Martin. His hair is cut in the way that it was when he left.
Ironically, it's not. That's what actually one of
Oh, no, I was wrong. Please take me back to the church. That's horrible. Sorry.
Yeah, it is. Liberty and white bread. Okay. So, let's...
I imagine you just step up and say whatever you could, even if it was so minimal, just to stay in your place. That's horrible.
Yeah. And you'll see, literally everybody testifies just because it's literally, as far as they're concerned, it's their immortal soul on the line.
Yeah. This is witch trials without the witch. This is just...
Oh, the witch comes later.
Okay, all right.
There's actually several witches in
witch,
this.
Witch.
Yes. So let's consider what I just said kind of a really rough scaffolding for this.
Okay.
And we'll flesh out the details because this has some really, really weird facets. There's a lot of reliable facts about this, even though it's such an old case, because two immensely popular books were written about the case immediately after it was resolved. It went on to inspire play, two novels, a musical, and a famous French movie. I got most of my facts from a book titled The Return of Martin Guerre, written in 1983. And I'm going to actually put a link to the book description.
Yeah, because now I need this book.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff I'm not going to be able to fit into this. Yeah. It's a really interesting case. A lot of more sociological stuff that I'm going to go into about Catholics and Protestants and sort of the understanding of the courts of the system. Like I said, I'm not going to go into all that, but it's a really good book. So Martin, son of Sanxi de Guerre, born in 1525 in Andailly, which is on the border of modern Spain and France. As I said, they spoke Basque, which isn't a common modern language. It's still around, but it kind of influenced modern French and Spanish. In Andailly, the family owned a farm and tile works, which had been handed down through generations. For some reason, don't know why, when Martin was two, he, his parents, and his uncle Pierre all moved to Artigue. This is in southern modern France, north of the Pyrenees Mountains and just off of the Lez River. At the time, it's the most important parish. According to the census reports, there are probably less citizens today than there were in the 1500s. Yeah, highest ever population was in the 1800s, never over 50 though.
Hmm.
The Wikipedia page for this town is a couple of paragraphs and Martin mentioned, but there's between the trade possibilities along the river, the fact that peasants there don't have to pay so much in taxes and could own property, it was a good place to settle at the time. The family got land east of the Lez and set up another tile works and another small farm. They tried to adjust to the local culture, altered their name from Deguerre to just Guerre. They are described as living comfortably for the time, but this is also the 1500s, so they talk about how many of their children live to adulthood.
Yeah.
This is a weird one because every now and then you get to this point where it's like, oh, this is very modern feeling. And then it's like...
You get those little reminders.
It just slaps you at the medieval times.
Josephine made it to the ripe age of 26.
Yes. Oh, very much so, yeah. But Martin would have had four sisters. Who actually survived. In 1538, Martin married Bertrand de Rolle from a very well-off family in what we would see as a strained marriage. And this is where things get gross.
Okay.
Bertrand later stated in court documents that both of them were under 10 years old. Other accounts say that Martin was older, possibly as old as 14. Their marriage certificate doesn't exist, so it's kind of iffy. But even for the time, this was considered a little bit weird. Like when this case went to more genteel areas, it was considered a bit odd and unusual and pretty much illegal, actually. And all of that makes me feel really, really icky when I point out that a major point in this is that there were claims that Martin was impotent because he couldn't consummate the marriage. Yeah, the less said about this, the better, but it is part of...
Yikes.
Yes. Bertrand's family wanted her to leave Martin because of this, and the locals would have been really hard on him for it.
But he wouldn't be.
Oh, God, did you have to?
I didn't have to. It's my brain.
It's okay.
It's the only way I can deal with this.
There was a local tradition to haze impotent men, which involved cross-dressing and banging pots and ringing bells outside their houses all night.
What?
Yeah, people were terrible historically.
Yeah, I mean, they're still not great, but who sits around deciding, you know what, this is what we do.
Yes.
Anybody got any extra pots and pans?
Cialis wasn't invented. Let's go ring a bell and cross-dress.
Yeah, people.
So Bertrand and Martin thought they were under a witch's spell.
Yeah, there's the witch.
So 8 years into their marriage, between 18 and 22, depending on whose account you believe, it was lifted. They said an old woman appeared suddenly as if from heaven and told them how to lift this. It involved eating cake and going to church.
Huh.
Yeah.
If only I'd known earlier to cure impotence, eat cake and go to church. You know, let them eat cake.
So French. So Patron finally got pregnant, and they had a son named Sanxi after Martin's father. So it's 1544. Martin is somewhere between 18 and 24 years old, depending on what accounts you're looking at. A new father to a baby, described not really as a go-getter. Martin stole some barley from his father. There's an argument, and he just ran away, disappearing, zero contacts with the parents, zero contacts with his wife. So let's talk about women's rights, or how there were none at the time.
Yep, they were barely there.
Mm-hmm. If you were widowed, you were allowed to have your original dowry plus a third more. Most widows were cared for by their sons, but there really wasn't a method for husbands up and skedaddling. Huge scandal in the area. Both of Martin's parents died while he's gone. His father, Sanxi, before he passed, eventually forgave him and wrote that he was heir to the property. Both properties, actually. The local magistrate decided that until he came back, the holdings would be handled by his uncle Pierre. During this time, Bertrand was a mother in her early 20s. She's described as beautiful and basically left without any way to support herself, her child, and the system. The Pope had actually decreed that women who were not allowed to remarry if their husbands...
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, classic.
Mm-hmm.
Classic.
Thankfully, first her in-laws and then Pierre were aiding her as she raised her son. Then it gets weird.
Wait, hold on. And now it gets weird.
Part of this, Pierre, Martine's uncle, married Bertrand's widowed mother.
I'm going to need a float. Like, I'm going to need a tree or a chart at some point.
Yes. Her mother was now also her mother-in-law. The kids had an auntie grandma. Yeah.
Okay.
So, again, local gossip. So in 1556, a man arrives in the next village over, suffering from the pox, which was probably syphilis, and told the hotel keeper he was Martin Guerre. When somebody mentioned his family, he burst into tears, saying that he was too ashamed to return. Of course, gossip traveled quickly, his sisters show up, and they had a tearful reunion and sent for Bertrand. She was understandably conflicted showing up. Martin had grown a big beard, so she didn't recognize him immediately, but I have seen your ID before you grew a beard.
I mean, fair enough. Yeah, I am two different people, actually. Yeah.
You can kind of...
We're not putting that one online, though.
No, it's fine. They talked. He talked about his marriage. One thing that was a very big, like, aha moment for her was he described exactly where he had left a pair of white hose before he left, which a very good identifier. She was said to kiss his neck, which I'm guessing had something to do because she really didn't like the beard.
Yeah, fair enough.
His uncle comes. They reminisce about old times. Bertrand actually nursed him back to health at the hotel for months before Martin went home. He chatted with all the curious locals. He claimed that when he was away, he had been serving in the army of the King of France and had ended up in Spain, but that all he wanted was to go home, be with his wife and his kid. They settled in. Martin claimed his estate. He moved into the large house, once owned by Sanxi, and took over the farming business, expanding it to have even more trade. He started leasing land and took earning more money. Bertrand seemed really happy to have him back, regardless of her thoughts about his leaving, and they have two more daughters in 3 years, one of whom survived. By all accounts, marriage is peaceful, loving, better than it was ever before.
Okay. Sometimes you just need a little syphilis, yeah, I guess. Exactly. Yeah, a pox upon this house is not a curse in this little town.
So Martine asks his uncle for a full accounting of the money, which was left in inheritance for him. This is on the heels of a family spat where Martine attempted to sell off some of their ancestral family lands. When Pierre refused to cooperate, Martine actually brings a civil suit against him. Like I said, this case, sometimes it's very modern sounding, sometimes it's very medieval. During this family infighting, it started Pierre thinking, was this guy really Martine? 12 years had passed. Martine had obviously changed, growing the beard, being a lot stockier, and didn't seem to remember many Basque phrases, which was a major
thing. That's interesting. Mm-hmm.
But they didn't have fingerprints.
Right.
They didn't have pictures. You know, this was all by memory. He convinced his wife, who again was Bertrand's mother, this is a family bush, this was an imposter, and she tried to convince Bertrand to bring a case against Martine, but Bertrand refused. Whole village becomes divided. People on either side. Martine said the whole story was made up to besmirch him and was proof that Pierre had mismanaged his account. His sisters swore, no, that's our brother. Everyone had an opinion. Pierre beat him with a club and tried to hire a hitman. Family tempers, a little high.
Just a little high. Yeah. 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 Again, some can sound like modern times. Like who knows?
I don't know if it would be a club in modern times.
I mean,
not many people carry around cudgels anymore.
Bring back cudgels. 2024. This is the year we do it.
So in 1559, two things happen that make this worse. A soldier passing through says, oh yeah, Martin's another guy. I recognize him. And then a barn burned down and Martin was accused of arson, which there's not enough information on, by the way.
I mean, fair enough. We're not in the larceny region of France, so it's not arson.
It's sparkling fire.
Correct.
So he's arrested for the arson, sent to Toulouse, where his charges mentioned that there was this theory of being an imposter, but he was eventually released. In order to get him charged for faking his identity, Pierre lied to the judge of Rue, I didn't get the pronunciation, and claimed to be working as an agent for Bertrand. He wasn't, but he claimed he was. Had a formal inquiry into his identity open. Martine is back in prison in 1560 with a trial set to take place in Rue. With Martine in prison, Bertrand was threatened by her mother-in-law slash mother, or her uncle-in-law slash mother, I should say, and her father-in-law slash stepfather, to support them in the case, saying that she would be thrown out on the street if she didn't agree to testify that Martine's a fake. Bertrand kind of pulls this thing where she plays both sides now, which I kind of like. She said she would support Pierre against Martine, but also was sending clothes and food to Martine the whole time that he's in prison. So she's kind of working in the shadows too and influencing some of the people who are going to give testimony. The biggest problem to the court at this time, it's a lower level court. There's no concept identity theft at the time. Not many French peasants are like, you know what, I want to be a different French peasant.
Honestly, it's like, oh, his station in life is slightly better than mine. He got extra bread today. I'm going to be him tomorrow.
He has slightly fewer boils. I wish I was him. Yes,
that's what it all boils.
There's not really laws on the books to cover this, so it was considered an assault on a man's honor.
All right, okay.
You know, because you have to put it under sentencing. The death penalty is still the option here, if he's found guilty.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a wild error. So notaries corrected and wrote out testimonies of the initial witnesses, as most of the locals couldn't read or write. Bertrand gave an initial testimony, but then said she was being held against her will, and the court actually had her moved to a safe house. And this is when priests started threatening to excommunicate anybody who didn't testify. So 150 people showed up to give testimony. This is over a third of the population traveling all the way to Rue to show up in court. Witnesses from Artigay said that he had greeted them for the first time by name, discussed things that they did in the past. His sisters and brother-in-laws testified that he was telling the truth. Childhood friends testified that they knew him. He was said to have signifying marks, extra teeth, a scar, and warts. So probably a looker here.
I mean, good job on the prosthetics, whoever made up Martine II.
So he's searched, has all of these signifiers. But there's contrasting testimony from Pierre's side saying that he was actually a criminal pretending to be Martine Guerre. His shoemaker said it couldn't be him because Martine had a different shoe size. And Pierre was adamant that this was not his nephew. And then 60 people testified just because they didn't want to be excommunicated, saying they don't know.
I'm just waiting for the shoemaker to like jump up in the middle of the courtroom and be like, if the boot doesn't fit, you must acquit.
You know, I could have placed bets on you making that joke and I would have won. So Bertrand took the stand and talked about her marriage, going into a whole lot of detail about Martine being impotent and how they finally consummated the marriage. Apparently was still giving details after the judge told her, no, stop,
please. But then...
So Martine took the stand, answered all the questions correctly. He collaborated things said in written testimonies, described what people had worn at his wedding 15 years prior at this point. He agreed with Bertrand's testimony. He said that the shoemaker was in cahoots with Pierre. He's described as being open, honest, and he did this all on his own without a lawyer with the threat of a death penalty.
Impressive. All right. I mean, fair enough.
Yeah. So after 3 months of trial, Martine was found guilty.
Fair enough.
The king's attorney asked for the death penalty, and the judge sentenced him to be beheaded and quartered.
Ah, the Braveheart treatment. Okay.
So Martine appealed to the Parliament of Toulouse, and Bertrand paid for the appeal. The appeal started in 1560. Court in Toulouse was much larger, much more prominent than previous court. While awaiting trial, Martine, like all other prisoners, was held in chains. Most of his fellow prisoners were actually being held on charges of heresy. Court gets its case together, starting with the testimony of Bertrand and Martine. And this court was so swayed by their accounts, they decided to lock up Pierre as well.
Here we go. Full family reunion. Great.
Like I said, this is a messy family. After this, they picked through the witnesses from the first trial, which, again, were fairly well split between he is, he isn't, and I don't know, but I want to be part of things. The testimony this time they decided to weigh towards people who had known Martine his whole life and his family. They tried to trip up Martine in questioning and questions about his life, but they couldn't catch him in a lie. There's no real solid evidence, though, in either direction. But Bertrand's testimony held the most weight, and it was considered a lot of evidence for Pierre falsely accusing Martine for his own gain. So much so that the court was actually considering having a confession tortured out of Pierre.
Here we go. Here's the good stuff.
Look, this is what I'm telling you. Like, this swings from, like, very modern to, you know, let's...
this, it feels like, I feel like at some point John Grisham dropped a manuscript down a sewer and it ended up in some weird twisted time warp. And this is the timeline that we now live in.
I can't say I've read much John Grisham, so I don't know how much uncle torture is in there.
Not enough.
Okay.
Not enough.
We'll put that on the Amazon review.
John Grisham, if you're listening, more uncle torture.
That's the Goodreads suggestion. So the court is in its final consideration, and it seems to be leaning towards declaring Martine innocent. This is the moment in the musical that the orchestra goes quiet. In the French films, the court interrupts its verdict and you hear incoming footsteps. Step thud, step thud, step thud. Because there is no way not to do this dramatically. Because the man who shows up in this story at this point claimed to be Martine Guerre.
Here we go. Play the French horn. We got it.
The biggest difference is this Martine had lost his leg and was walking on a wooden leg.
All right.
He hadn't lost it naturally. It wasn't just a decision to do that to be dramatic.
Yeah, I was wondering. I was like, okay, how much weirder can this story get? It's pretty weird.
Writing things down, you know. What should I do to be more dramatic? Eye patch? No.
No. Yes.
The court goes into a total spiral. No one knows what the hell to do in this situation.
I really hope that, like, he entered in this dramatic fashion, looked around, looked at other Martine, and it's like, I bet you thought you had me pegged.
Excuse me while I wipe my face. I respect the puns. So one-legged Martine is questioned now and totally resents the fact that he's being questioned. Resisted answering just because he was like, how dare you question? And it gave the Martine who was on trial cause to declare him a fraud. Look, he won't even answer your questions, you know? This guy is on trial for his life, and this other dude's not even answering. Eventually, though, one-legged Martine realizes he's going to have to defend himself, so he started answering a lot more questions about his past. The opinions on the court started to sway about, was the real Martine? There's only one possibility. In the eyes of the prosecution, the man on trial, witch.
Witch, clearly. I want this to, no, the only way this can get, not the only way, because it's going to get weirder, but one direction this could go to make this just so much more enthralling is we have a real Spartacus moment and more people just start standing up and I'm Martine.
There's a different case I'm working on that basically that's what happens.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. So they create a real test. They got a bunch of men together, including both Martines, who looked similar, dressed them all the same, and then called in Martine's close family one by one. Pierre instantly recognizes the one-legged Martine as his brother. Then the sisters went back on their previous statements saying, no, the one-legged guy is is actually our brother. There's this big tearful reunion, and then they brought in Bertrand, who has been the biggest supporter of the Martine, who is on trial. Yes, the witch. She sees this one-legged man, bursts into tears, and begs for business.
How did I accidentally call this? What is this? What is happening?
So the real Martin Guerre being found is immediately a real jerk to Bertrand. Blames this whole thing on her, even though he was the one who left in the first place.
Clearly the real one.
Yeah. Leaving pseudo-Martine in a bad place.
So, pseudo-Martine. Okay, I like that.
So, yeah. Who is he? They actually found his name earlier in the trial. Had kind of tripped over it. His name was Arnaud Dutille, and born in the diocese of the Lombez, which is southwest in a full day's travel from Artigue. Arnaud was known to have an excellent memory, was charismatic, but was being described as absorbed in every vice. He drank and visited prostitute, cheated at cards, and was nicknamed Pancette, meaning the belly, for his appetite. After being arrested for theft, he was sent to serve Henri II in the army. In Arnaud's confession, he said that he had never heard of Martin Guerre until one day, weird day, in 1553, where he was passing along and bumped into two of Martin's friends who mistook. Arnaud asks a ton of questions, finding out everything he could about Martine in detail. There were accusations that the two friends might have been complicit.
Kind of, okay. Yeah.
But there's so much gossip about Martine's absence locally that he could find out a lot from a wider area. He actually studied for several months, only claiming Martine's identity in 1556. He used the time where Bertrand nursed him back to health to grill her for every little detail about Martine's life. Meanwhile, the real Martine went over the Pyrenees into Spain, learned how to speak Castilian, lived in a large city, Burgos, and worked as a lackey in the house of a Roman Catholic cardinal. He went into the Spanish army. He was French, but went into the Spanish army, fought for Philip II, and fought against the French. In 1557, he was hit by a French arquebus and lost his leg. Afterwards, he was given a position as a lay brother in a military order, which was really considered fairly cushy. There's a lot of contemporary belief, but very little proof, that the two of them might have bumped into each other during their time military service, but they were in opposite armies. So,
right.
Yeah, probably not. Probably just happy accident. Epilogue for Martine was that he reclaimed his inheritance. Bertrand didn't face any repercussions, as the court believed that she had been truly fooled. In the book, they don't necessarily believe that, that she knew all along. I'm kind of on the fence. I find her a very interesting character.
Well, to be fair, like, this man who runs out on you leaves you in this very weird social standing where there weren't actually standards to deal with at the time. Someone comes along who is nicer and kinder to you. I wouldn't blame her if she was like, I know this isn't you.
This man runs out on you who you were basically raised beside.
Yeah.
Like a brother.
Yeah.
It's, yeah. Daughter that Bertrand had with Arnaud was legitimized, and she and Martine went on to have more children. Everyone seemed to ignore that Martine actively fought against the French for years.
I think all of them do it at some point.
It's a French thing.
It's a French thing.
Arnaud, though, he had just been found to be impersonating a man for 3 years, committed adultery in the eyes of the church, and basically committed a crime that had absolutely no precedence. By the terms of the courts of the day, they were very, very sympathetic. His belongings weren't seized. He was allowed to leave money to his daughter that he had had with Bertrand, and he wasn't tortured or excommunicated. He was allowed to make a full confession, but it's still the 1500s, so he was sentenced to be hung and his body burned.
Yeah, okay. I was wondering, you know, when he was going to become deceased.
Yeah, that was the penny drops. It's the 1500s. Yeah. It's going to happen. But, you know, hey, you know, it was, like, considered a really lenient sentence.
I mean, honestly, yeah, like, I was expecting the full gamut of every worst potential outcome possible. And it's like, well, first, we're going to torture you. We're going to seize all of your property. Sorry, your child gets nothing. And right before we hang you, we will excommunicate you.
Yeah.
Right before it happens.
Yeah.
But no, it's just, no, you get hanged and we'll burn you.
Yeah, like I said, there's a lot more sociologically in play there, but, you know, that's the basics.
That's
so, yeah.
Fascinating. Okay. Didn't you, okay, was there... Did you mention a musical of this?
Mm-hmm.
Great. Because now I want this on Broadway. I am sick and tired at this point of Les Mis. Give me this story. I need this.
It's very Les Mis-like. Like,
that's why I was
staging,
like, wait, this is
the
so
staging
close.
Of it, I was like, oh, that looks like the classic Les Mis stage. I have to say this, the movie, which ironically, I could only find the movie online. It is in French because it's a French movie. The subtitles were in Spanish.
Oh, perfect.
So
it's because they border Spain. Like, why?
Yeah, so
what'd you expect?
There's a lot of, you can get what's going on, but brain kind of doesn't communicate. Yes. Quickly. But in both of those, basically, the real Martine walks in and everyone immediately goes, where actually there was more pondering in that.
Yeah.
But it is the most dramatic scene because by that point, you really do think that he was like being falsely accused. Yes. Now, in the book, it basically kind of buries the lead a bit, but I can understand the difference between a historical recount and the dramatic.
A dramatization.
To the drama.
Yeah. It's the Martine scene. Yeah. All right. No, that was fascinating.
Yes.
I don't, my brain is going through so many scenarios and things right now of just, how often do you think this actually happened in other places that was just never recorded?
Yeah.
It's one of those things that most of the time you wouldn't want to be another peasant. But if you found a way, especially if you were bored, or you had done all you could at this point in your life, what else is left to do other than you realize, oh, someone's gone missing from this town. I'm going to become this person. And imagine the lineages that procreated that you just don't know. That, like, this wasn't actually great-great-grandpa Joe.
So not to give you too much prescience on what I'm planning on doing with this podcast, but I have 3 full pages of false identities and stolen identities.
Excellent.
And all of them go weird places. It's one of those, like, you start out and it's like, and then you're like, how did I end up here? The rabbit holes on those aren't straight down. So it's going to be, yeah, you're going to be hearing a lot of people. But a French peasant was odd. And it's odd because this one was so well documented at the time.
Yeah.
By people who were professionals of the court.
Yeah, this is the 16th century. Why is this even being talked about to this degree? That's the fascinating part, that so much of this was recorded. Interesting. All right, so you heard it here first. As we get the Patreon up and running, as we start monetizing what we're doing here, we will eventually open and crowdfund our own false identity musical. So please be ready for that. The stage play will be off Broadway to begin. We'll start touring. We'll figure out how we're going to do this, what the casting's going to look like. But guess what? It's false identity. You can be whoever you want to be. We're not even going to check at the door. And because of that, from this side of the microphone, don't believe everything you hear. This is Beggar's Belief. Thank you.